the week of July 25th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 64, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in beautiful downtown Long Island City, Queens, New York, I'm Michael Gillis.
Yes, Michael coming to us live from whatever assignment he's on this week. Hopefully, it seems like you're going to be on assignment for at least the next couple of weeks. So thank you for joining us and taking time out of your schedule. And speaking of schedules, I don't want to belabor the intros here or the teases up front because we have so much to talk about this week. Comic-Con was held over the weekend in San Diego. We'll be talking to three journalists who attended the annual event. From the Los Angeles Times, we'll have Jeff Boucher. And from First Showing, we'll have Alex Billington. And we'll have from Thompson on Hollywood, which can be found on IndieWire, Ann Thompson joining us. Then we're going to move on and talk to Alex Pham, who is also with the LA Times, about digital comics, as well as digital books. She is writing a series along with a couple of other journalists at the Times, a series on the future of reading. We'll then move on to talk about the announcement by Andrew Wiley, who is a big book agent, that he will be publishing his clients' ebooks, going around traditional publishers such as Random House. Rachel Deal from Publishers Weekly will join us to discuss that news story. Of course, we always have Big Deal or Big Whoop, our lightning round of top headlines from the week. And during Inside Baseball this week, we'll actually be talking about Sumner Redstone, the head of Viacom, and why he's leaving prank voice messages. Although I guess they're not prank messages, they are kind of threatening voicemails.
They're cranky.
Yes.
And I'm outside Cranky's Cafe in Long Island City.
Oh, well, how appropriate then. So we should preface it. If Michael kind of breaks up a little bit audio-wise, it's because he's kind of taking some time off from one of his assignments. Now, speaking of Michael, we always begin each episode with a rundown of the week's, or weekend's, top box office results. Michael Giltz, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, take it away.
The big question of the week was not apparently who is Salt, but who is the number one movie of the week? And the answer is Inception, Christopher Nolan film starring Leonardo DiCaprio. That grossed $43.5 million this weekend. It's at $143 million total. Anyone watching the daily figures knew it was going to have another great weekend because it's been grossing about $8 to $10 million a day, Monday through Thursday. Number two was Angelina Jolie's Salt, which opened at $36.5 million. A solid opener, but we'll have to see how the word of mouth is going on that. Number three was Despicable Me, which grossed $24 million. That's the animated film starring Steve Carell. It's made $161 million so far in the U.S. It's sure to blow past $200 million. It's a bona fide blockbuster. And number four is The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is a bona fide flop. That grossed $9.6 million this weekend for a modest total of $42 million total for a movie that costs about $150 million to make and a lot more to market. Number five is Toy Story 3, which everyone has seen, everyone loves, and everyone cries over. That cost another $9 million. It's at $379 million total. It's sure to blow past $400 million. Number six is another new film, Ramona and Beezus, based on the best-selling children's novels by Ramona Cleary. And that
Beverly grossed, Cleary.
Cleary, right? That grossed
Ramona
$8 million,
Quimby.
That grossed $8 million. But it only costs $50 million to make, so that's going to be all right. And then round out the top 10, Grown Ups, Adam Sandler's movie grossed another $7.6 million. The Twilight Saga Eclipse grossed another $7 million. That's a $280 million total. The Last Airbender, neither a hit nor a flop, at least at the box office. That grossed $4.1 million for $123 million total. It'll probably double that overseas. And at number 10 is Predators, which grossed $2.8 million and is almost done with $46 million total. So I saw Salt, which I thought was hilariously bad. It was just ludicrous. I don't know what you guys saw. What did you see this weekend?
I'm sorry, you said you saw Salt, correct? You broke up there.
I saw Salt, yes, which I thought was hilariously ludicrous. I just laughed my whole way through the movie. It was not good, but I was so entertained I had to give it 2 stars out of 4.
Oh, I'm totally seeing that this weekend. I didn't see anything. It was my mom's 70th birthday.
Oh, bless her heart. What did you get her for her birthday?
What did I get her? Me. I went home.
That's a great present.
What more could she possibly want?
What more could anybody possibly want?
Sperling, did you see anything this weekend?
No, I was going to see Salt, but I had seen enough of it in at trade shows that I just thought, you know what?
Saw the movie.
Yeah.
You know it's not good. Why bother?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why. There's nothing she does that's any more ludicrous than what Jason Bourne or James Bond do. But when the movie doesn't work, everything seems so silly. I mean, she jumps from the roof of one truck to another, and all I could think of was Frogger, the old video game. And, I mean, it's just, everybody has ridiculous Russian accents. It's just silly, silly, silly. But, you know, what are you going to do? But I'm telling you, if based on New York Times Square, my God, every screening was sold out. You would have thought it was a blockbuster. People in New York, she's got a big urban following. Angelina Jolie, I'll say that for her. So people in New York love her.
People in New York love Liev Schreiber, too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Liev Schreiber. He's one of those actors that just seems inherently untrustworthy on camera. He can play nice, decent guys, but you just know you can't trust him.
Yeah.
But I have a 3D note. I'm sorry about that, Karen. But first, there was a trailer for The Green Hornet. And at the end, of course, it says The Green Hornet in 3D. And a guy in the audience spoke up and said, 3D? You got to be kidding me. I mean, that was just his reaction to the idea that it was in 3D. And then I was in the Heartland, Birmingham, Alabama, with my nieces and nephews, and we were all talking about Toy Story 3 and this despicable me. And they all love Toy Story 3, of course. They all started talking about 3D, unprompted by me. They said, I don't like it, it's stupid. Another one said, I don't want to do it until I don't have to wear the glasses. I want to be able to look at 3D, but I don't want to have to wear the glasses. And the third one said, it's just too expensive. So there you go. That's the Heartland.
And none of those were prompted by you.
That's right. I was like, what do you think of 3D? What do you think of it? They just started saying what they thought about it. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's just, people are not going to stop going to see movies in 3D, but I do feel like there's a strong resistance to the big bonus price of $3 a ticket.
Well, yeah. You know, Toy Story 3, a 3D film, opened over the weekend in the UK, earned $30.6 million. It's the highest opening of an animated film in the UK.
In history?
I believe so, yeah. Of course, that's not accounting for ticket price inflation. It made $62 million, that film, Toy Story 3, internationally this weekend.
So it's just getting going.
Yeah, it's just getting going. And Salt made $5.1 million, but in 17 smaller territories. The surprising thing about Salt is that an action film was attracting more women than men, 53% more men. Sorry, more women. And 59% of those women were over the age of 25. So,
that's because they're Angelina Jolie fans. It has nothing to do with the fact that it's an action movie or not.
Well, we could talk about box office probably for another good 10 minutes, but we should probably get some of our guests on.
Who are our guests?
Joining us now, we have Jeff Boucher, the pop culture writer and lead blogger for The Hero Complex. Of course, he's been on with us before. So has Ann Thompson from IndieWire and Thompson on Hollywood. We reference her blog at least two or three times per episode. So you're sure if you're listening to this show, you know who Ann Thompson is. And joining us for the first time is Alex Billington from First Showing. Now, all of you were at Comic-Con this week. Jeff, you run a comic book and comic-oriented blog. What did you think of this year's edition or version of Comic-Con down in San Diego?
Well, I've been down there before, and it's always a heaping helping. It's more than you can handle of good, bad, and loud, and vivid, and did I mention loud? There's a lot of loud. I thought this year was great. You know, I always have a good time down there. I thought there were some really clear-cut winners, some people that sort of stepped forward, either sort of defined new projects or maybe earned some confidence for some returning projects. And then I thought there's some people that might have fizzled a little bit.
Well, who were the big winners this year?
Yeah, and who fizzled?
This is just my humble opinion. I thought that the Marvel guys really kind of lit it up with that that sort of rock and roll concert ending of the Hall H program on Saturday. I thought they brought footage from Captain America, which only started shooting 12 days ago, which is just nuts that they had something to show, which was good. I thought the Thor stuff looked stronger than a lot of people anticipated. And then they brought out a parade of stars at the end. I was up there on stage. I was moderating the panel. And it was just kind of a startling thing to be standing next to it. They brought out Robert Downey Jr. and Scarlett Johansson and Sam Jackson and about 77,000 other people. I thought that was pretty strong. I thought Sucker Punch was strong.
Now, this is the Zack Snyder film, Sucker Punch.
Yeah, Sucker Punch, which is Zack Snyder's follow-up to Watchmen, and it's his first non-adapted feature film. I mean, he did Dawn of the Dead, and he did 300, and those are based on a previous film, obviously, and a well-known graphic novel, and Watchmen is probably the most celebrated graphic novel ever, or a comic book series turned into a graphic novel. But anyway, Zack has written this movie that's sort of like Alice in Wonderland meets One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a horrible shorthand description of it, but it'll have to do for the purposes of this conversation. And then, you know, I thought the Fringe panel was really great. I really liked that show, and I kind of enjoyed that. I thought Dexter was great. So, you know, those are things that jumped out that I liked. As far as Fizzled, you know, I'm not sure Green Hornet won a lot of people over. That's just my view. And, you know, I think Harry Potter had a really huge missed opportunity. They had Tom Felton there.
Why was it missed? Oh, not bringing the cast.
Yeah, just not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just putting one guy up there. And, you know, I had gone and talked to the lineup, 300 people in line, and almost every person I talked to was there for Potter, and they were all convinced that the big three, as I like to call them, were going to be there. Of course, by that, I mean Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. But the you know, the main three weren't there.
It played very well, though. I mean, I had people just raving about the Harry Potter footage itself. That they just thought it was, you know, one guy was going on about how it was going to be nominated for an Oscar. It was so great.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I think the footage was great, and I think it could get nominated for an Oscar with 10 nominees in that category. But I just felt like if they had had a panel there, it would be the thing that everybody was talking about. And I think it's on the list of things a lot further down the list than it could have been. So that's not so much that they lost or did badly or that the footage was bad. I'm just talking a missed opportunity. I just think that they could have set the tone for everything. But now I think you would put them under a lot of the other famous faces that went across that stage.
Well, I would love to differ with you a little bit on the Marvel thing, because I thought that Captain America looked better than I expected, and the fact that they're setting it in the 40s was a very smart move, and it all seemed to fit together. I liked the idea of Hugo Weaving, you know, as Red Skull and everything. But the other Thor just looked very expensive, and I was underwhelmed by Chris Hemsworth. And of all of them, I thought Thor looked the weakest, and I hate the costume. I it's not the Thor I grew up with, the bright-colored, blonde, Nordic god. You know, it just doesn't look right to me at all. And as much as I was impressed by the star power on the stage for the Avengers, I'm still, just as an event, as a moment, as a theatrical thing, of course, it was hugely successful and was what everyone was talking about. But I'm still looking at, is the movie going to be any good? And I still have serious doubts about Joss Whedon being able to pull that off.
I guess we should say that Joss Whedon was announced as the director of The Avengers.
I'm just saying, I think it's a tall order, you know, for them to pull these movies off. I'm marveling at their audacity. We'll see if they deliver.
You're exactly right. It is. It's pretty audacious. The fact that the stars came out on stage and didn't know where to stand doesn't bode well for a movie.
And there was some booze. There were some booze for the Ed Norton not being there and Mark Ruffalo being there in his place. And he looked very uncomfortable, I thought. He's a great actor. He can do anything. You know, I'm sure it'll be fine, but it's tricky.
And I guess we should also say that Mark Ruffalo, as we reported last week, was announced as the Hulk, replacing Ed Norton.
That's
and
right.
He always looks uncomfortable.
That's true. Very true. That's his MO.
But Alex, obviously, with TV and Hawaii 5.0 and movies, and I mean, this should be called Pop Culture Con, not Comic-Con. Isn't that right?
It's definitely interesting to see Comic-Con take the route of getting, you know, going beyond just comics. But you're right. It should be called Pop Culture Con by now. But yeah. I think it's just a name that sticks and everyone loves being a part of it just because it is Comic-Con, even though there's so much more outside of just comics.
Now, Anne, why don't you explain to our listeners, what is Comic-Con? What we hear about it, we read about it, but really, what is it overall?
Well, it's morphed into something much more. I mean, I would say that it's a great marketing opportunity at this stage for all the studios and networks and everything. I mean, if you go on the floor, if you go on the exhibition floor, you see what it really has been all along, which is a wonderful celebration for all these people who love the characters and the worlds that they're passionate about, whether they're comic books or television or movies. You see them in their costumes wandering the floor, and I always get a big kick out of the purity of that, the genuine fan passion that is there. But when you're in Hall H, which is the place where 6,000 of them assemble to see the big panels that Jeff Boucher very ably handled his panels. I would say that you do see this enormous marketing effort on display. And I read one piece that I was struck by where all the bloggers and media people covering the con, as they call it, are being caught, you know, they're being caught up in the marketing effort. You know, you have these big fan sites where everybody's very enthusiastic and ebullient and excited. And there doesn't seem to be the same kind of more reasonable, sane, pulled back kind of approach to covering it, and everybody gets caught up in the marketing of what the studios are doing. I mean, I don't know, Jeff and Alex, if you agree with that or not.
I agree. I think you know, people do get caught up in the kind of the overriding rhythm of the event. You know, the drumbeat of it, and you know, it's short of the Oscars. You know, you don't. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's more like American Music Awards. You don't see that kind of parade of people, and a lot of the press aren't used to getting that kind of access to them and stuff, so they do get kind of caught up in the swirl. You know, the thing on the floor, you're exactly right. You know, there's this crush of humanity and a lot of people in costumes, but it is amazing how little space on that floor is now dedicated to actually buying and selling comic books. You know, because even like, you know, DC Comics has a big thing there, but you can't really buy comics there. It's to promote their overall IP, intellectual property and stuff. But as far as like old musty boxes of comics that I used to go through when I went to the comic book convention down in Miami, I grew up in South Florida, the real estate given to that is very, very small now. And, you know, it's called Comic-Con, but, you know, we still call movies because they're motion pictures. But I mean, it feels like, I mean, we don't call them talkies anymore, but I guess they technically are still talkies. But you're right, they could call this thing Omnicon or something, or just, they could just call it buy, or sell, or something like that.
It wouldn't be a bad idea to separate them out a little bit. I feel like it's too much in one place. There have been a couple of calls for that. What do you think?
I feel like it would lose its magic if you started separating pieces of con from the con. You know, it's even just moving some of the panels off-site. To me, I almost don't have any interest in seeing the off-site panels because they almost feel like they're not a part of Comic-Con.
Did any of you see the Scott Pilgrim panel, or did they show the film there? I mean, it's got a lot of buzz.
I would say that was one of the more successful marketing efforts there, and I did see the film, and I was it got a very good reaction. I think the marketing was brilliant, actually. They did a lot of viral marketing with viral marketing with the.
It was also very manly.
Very viral, very Michael Cera, very viral, boyishly. So they were doing, you know, make your own T-shirts and get your picture taken with Brandon Routh and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the movie itself played very, very well. I am not the target demo. I'm a little too, I'm not a video game player. And I think that has a lot to do with, I like Edgar Wright a lot. It was witty and fun, but I suspect it's going to play younger than my demo, certainly.
I was actually at the screening as well. And I am the demographic that it caters to. And being in that theater with, I think it was like 1,300 seats with 1,300 other people who also were just really excited to see it. They pulled off a great marketing gig for that. Just everything worked out perfectly. I think the buzz for it is going to be insane, at least for this demographic, going out of Comic-Con.
Now, Jeff, did you host or moderate the panel for The Expendables? Oh, no, I guess that was Harry Knowles of Ain't It Cool News moderated that panel I'm seeing now. But Steve Zajcik of the LA Times headline was at panel for Sylvester Stallone's Expendables. World's testosterone shortage is remedied. Did any of you see that panel, and was the headline better than the panel, I guess is what I'm asking?
I saw half of it.
I came in on the end of it, Frank.
Jeff, did you see it?
I did a big piece on Sly and spent a day with him, so I had my fill. I skipped it.
Now, The Green Hornet also made a lot of news. This is the film with Seth Rogen playing the action hero. Jeff, is that something that worked?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's Michel Gondry is the director and has made it clear that he likes kind of 1980s sort of spirited films. He says his two favorite films of all time are RoboCop and Back to the Future, and which is an interesting sentence in and of itself. He he said that he liked the older superhero movies. He doesn't really like the newer stuff, which is either very serious or very kind of hyper real. He kind of likes something that is has a fun spirit, that feels grounded in reality, and it kind of shows. I mean, this movie reminded me, I don't know, it's not like Darkman, but it feels like that kind of universe to me.
Darkman being the Sam Raimi,
which is kind of a throwback. And it's not as silly as Darkman.
Yeah, I talked to Gondry there, and he's getting notes from the studio every week.
Well, that is the type of movie that you would get notes on.
I don't know. I think it's not of the moment. And you guys were talking about Scott Pilgrim. I didn't see it down in San Diego, but I did see it up here. And I just thought it killed. I thought it was great. I think that movie's the one that people really circled coming out. And Alex is exactly right. They marketed it in a really ingenious way, very true to its roots, and also very open and inclusive.
I've got a question about Scott Pilgrim. Are we tired of Michael Cera yet?
I kind of was when the movie started, but not when it finished.
I like him. He's actually more athletic and sort of tough than he has been in the past.
That was just special effects.
Well, Alex, is Alex still on? Have we lost Alex yet?
I think Alex, his internet connection.
Oh,
I think
bad.
We lost Alex, actually.
I have no idea how old he is, but he clearly seems to be a 14-year-old boy.
He's a mature man. I
don't mean that. I mean, like, he's a real, well, I'm a demo. I'm like, oh, really?
Well, yeah, I mean, and the reason I thought he would make a good addition to this panel is because, really, he runs a site that is kind of a fan site. And I would say over time, more and more bloggers and blogging sites have become fan sites. I mean, and you don't fall into that category, but
I'm neither does. I mean, Jeff has a great fan following, but I think he still functions as a journalist, which is what I'm trying to do as well. I think a lot of the very popular sites serve their readers very well, but they're not necessarily doing what we would call rigorous journalism. They're much more, offering up information and trying to give people what they want to know, as opposed to, you know, without. It's hard to, they're not all the same, and I like his site very much.
It's funny, Ann and I were just having this conversation down in San Diego about this sort of the change in tone. Ann and I don't see each other very often. I think that was the first time that you and I had actually bumped into each other in many months, but I mean, this is something that is foremost on our mind, is that, you know, you look around and you do go from people who service the industry, and when I say service, I mean it's sort of in the clute sense of the word. And I don't know, is the clue reference too vague? Is that
No, we got it.
and it, you have, it's a lot of people are very enthusiastic, and but they don't bring a filter to it, and they don't bring any sense of questioning or offering context and things like that. And you know, it's clear, you know, I am a fanboy. I mean, I do have a passion for this stuff, but I try to, like Ann says, is, you know, you try to bring a sense of, you know, what's going on in the industry and ask hard questions and remember that, you know, you work for the reader, and that credibility with them is far more important than anything else.
Well, now, Comic-Con has become a place to make big announcements, and it looks like Guillermo del Toro made a big announcement, or at least Disney did. They will be making a film version of their theme park ride, The Haunted Mansion. And Guillermo del Toro will be directing the film and co-writing with his Don't Be Afraid of the Dark co-writer, Matthew Robbins. What was the buzz on that? That seems like a very odd choice.
I happened to run into Sean Bailey, who's the producer of Tron, who's the Disney head of production now, and because Don't Be Afraid of the Dark was a Miramax title, they had the opportunity to get to know Del Toro and went after him for Haunted Mansion because they recognized that they needed someone who could bring a certain authenticity to it and throw off the bad vibes connected to the Eddie Murphy version. And Del Toro was very funny. He said he would not be taking Eddie Murphy's call. So that's a question of someone who has great passion for that e-ride and is willing to go for it. And I think it's a great idea and he'll bring something to it. Speaking of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, that was one of my favorite projects that I was introduced to at the con. I thought it looked fantastic.
You know, Guillermo, of course, signed that deal with Disney a while back. And I was wondering if the ticking clock on that was part of the reason that he had to walk away from The Hobbit.
I think that's true. I think that is true. And I think it was very hard for him to do, although it seems to be, he made another point that he thought, you know, he was hoping and praying that Peter Jackson himself would direct The Hobbit. And that must have been part of the conversation.
Well, besides movies, Comic-Con also has a number of television panels. Did any of you, Jeff, did you attend any of these television panels?
I did. Although before you moved on, I wanted to say I thought it was fascinating that during the discussion of Haunted Mansion that Disney mentioned Pirates of the Caribbean, but never mentioned Country Bears, which is actually, you know, oh, wait, never mind. I guess maybe that made sense after all. I'm just waiting for the People Mover movie. That's the one that I really, as far as the Disney attractions, that's the one that's foremost in my mind. As far as TV, I did go to some. Not as many as I would have liked. I would have liked to have made it to Smallville, but I didn't, just because I'm sort of intrigued by the kind of wrap-up and the fact that Tom Welling has played Superman longer than any other person in the history of the character. But I did make it. I moderated the Caprica panel, which I thought was great. And then I also moderated the Showtime panel with Mary Louise Parker, Michael C. Hall, and David Duchovny. And it was very difficult because they had some creators on the panel too. So it was like 8 or 9 people on the panel. It's just very large and unwieldy. And Mary Louise Parker is not
vociferous.
Easy.
Friendly. I guess we'll be. I'm searching for the term that I can have associated with my name as this moves forward through the world. I'll say that she. Maybe they have a spot for her in Haunted Mansion when he makes the movie.
Oh, okay. that could be taken any way. I guess some of the
I'm endorsing her career. What do you want?
Exactly. I guess some of the big news was that Glee will have a Rocky Horror Picture Show episode, and Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel will be coming back. And that was not from the Showtime panel, but the Showtime panel was one of the bigger panels that received a lot of ink, as did the True Blood panel. Alex, did you make it to that or Anne?
No, I didn't have time to do a lot of the TV ones. The one television project that I heard a lot about, The Walking Dead, for AMC, it's a series that got a lot of buzz at Comic-Con. I now am interested in pursuing that, making sure I see that based on everything I heard.
Alex, did you see that?
I didn't see it, but I saw the trailer after, and I've heard everyone's been talking about it since then, so I know it's got a lot of buzz from Comic-Con.
And overall, what was the big takeaway, Alex, from this year's Comic-Con for you as somebody who blogs about this kind of world?
I would say all the Marvel stuff and Tron Legacy, I think, were the biggest, just the most unforgettable moments of Comic-Con. Anything from that panel and those, that movie.
And Anne, what about you? What was
Of the stuff that we haven't covered yet, the movie that I thought looked the most promising, besides Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, was Let Me In. Which I cannot wait to see. And I spoke to a number of people who've actually seen it now. And even though it's a remake of a movie a lot of people liked a lot, the vampire film, Let the Right One In, this one looks really good. And it's from the guy who did Cloverfield. And it just felt right to me. So I'm looking forward to that.
And that's a horror film. Jeff, what about you? What did you walk away from this year's Comic-Con with?
You know, it's what my peers here said. I agree with both of them. I think those are things that jumped out. And just to be kind of old school, I'll say, you know, I was really struck by the time I got to spend with Neil Adams, the greatest living comic book artist, and the fact that he's going back and he's going to be drawing Batman in a 12-issue series called Odyssey, the first time since the 1970s. And the last time he drew Batman, I was reading it, and now I'm reading it again, but I'm taller. And he's also got some other stuff coming up, and he was a special guest there, and I spent some time with him, and it was interesting to see. I have a story coming up on him, and I'd love for you guys to check it out. And he talked about how Warner Brothers sent him a check for Dark Knight, even though he didn't have a screen credit or anything, because his version of Batman was so influential and stuff like that. So to me, that was kind of interesting to see how comic books and the legacy of those key comics kind of live on, even though the popular storyline is that that film has kind of stolen them. In some ways, it might be something a little better than theft.
Well, thank you all very much for taking the time to join us and fill us in on this year's Comic-Con. And your blog can be found on IndieWire, or if you type in thompsononhollywood.com into your web browser, you'll be taken directly to Anne's blog. And your Twitter handle is akstanwick. We'll place a link to that in the show notes. Alex, you're at firstshowing.com, and that is also your handle on Twitter, firstshowing.net. Oh, sorry, firstshowing.net. Thank you for correcting me. And Jeff Boucher can be found at the LA Times just about everywhere. When he's not moderating Comic-Con panels, he's writing for the Hero Complex blog, as well as many, many other sections of the paper.
Outlets?
Yeah, not outlets. I don't know where I was going with that sentence. But thank you all for joining us.
It was a treat.
Thanks. Well, we leave Jeff, Anne, and Alex behind to... And we don't leave them behind, but we are going to switch gears and talk about digital comics for a second with Alex Pham, who is also with the Los Angeles Times. She's the digital entertainment and technology writer, and presently she's working on a series called The Future of Reading with David Sarno, who is a technology writer at the Times, and David Ulan, who is the Times book critic. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you were also at Comic-Con over the weekend, and you began it with a great story on digital comic books and how that is affecting, I guess, the comic book industry. What was your major finding there?
Well, the biggest impression I have is that it's just starting out. So there's not a lot of data out there to show whether or not people are reading digital comics, whether or not it's doing better than the printed version, and just what the right format is for this market. So there's a lot of experimentation that the publishers are going through right now. And so you'll see lots of different flavors of digital comics as they kind of feel out the territory.
These comic books are being sent to smartphones and tablet devices. They're even on the Xbox and certain game consoles. And I'm sure they're on the Kindle, which is Amazon's ebook reader. But they add a little bit more than just the pictures and the words that make up a comic book, don't they?
They do. You're going to see two different types of comic books come on digital devices. The first is a more traditional version of the comic book, where you can pan and zoom through the traditional page. So it's the most literal visual port of the comic book to the screen on the various devices. And they pan and they zoom because, you know, some of the screens that we have are obviously much smaller than a comic book layout. The panning and zooming is really there to help people read. The speech bubbles and look at the pictures in greater detail and help them navigate through a comic book. The second type of digital comic that you're going to see is one that's a lot more produced. There will be a lot more bells and whistles, and it's much more, whereas traditional comics is a reading experience, motion comics are much more of a watching experience. So, for example, some of the digital motion comics that I bought in iTunes, I actually found in the TV show section of iTunes, not in the books section or even the app sections of iTunes. And that sort of tells you something. it's very much a sit back and watch it experience, where, you know, the panels flow. There's a narrator, you know, you have professional voice acting narrating the panels for you. You don't have to do anything. You don't even have to turn the page, and it all comes at you. There's some degree of animation. There's generally a soundtrack that goes with it. So it's a lot more production oriented and production intensive, and a lot more expensive to produce, frankly, than a more static comic book on a digital format.
Yeah, I've received some of those on DVD, episodes of Watchmen that were related to the movie, or some classic comic books that were turned into this sort of hybrid format. And it's really a bad case of neither fish nor fowl. I mean, it's less animated than a TV series. It's not, you know, it's sort of bad, half-assed animation, and it's just sort of really pictures that move just a tad, and it's just, it's not well done as a TV show would be. It's certainly not as well done as a movie. It's certainly not a comic book that you're just getting a nice visual presentation of. So it seems like this weird thing that there's no real demand for.
That's right. There are not a lot of fans for this type of comic book, particularly the people who love comic books the way they were, have contempt for this new type of motion comic. It's, I think Scott McCloud, who wrote Reinventing Comics, said it's comics sucking up to another art form, and
exactly.
That it's just pathetic, in his words. But it's early days. You know, you're going to find artists and writers who are not shy of taking advantage of the digital tools that technology has to offer to find novel ways to tell the story, using graphics and sound and animation and motion. We just haven't quite seen it yet. But that's not to say that, you know, that motion comics are, you know, we should relegate it to the trash bin of history for now. I think it's just starting out. And so, who knows?
Have you had a chance to look at what we would call, I guess, a standard comic book presented on like an iPad or something? Because they really are visually awesome, and they are sort of a comic book, but in a really beautiful presentation. And then you think about it and you say, hey, if you're creating it for an iPad rather than that paper product, you can make a panel that stretches, you know, a foot long or goes straight down. You can have something falling and falling and falling and scroll down, so the image is much bigger and more exciting than it would be if you were just looking at the actual physical comic book. It sort of gives you new opportunities of things to do visually that don't exist in a paper product, because the page only goes so far. And so that is sort
right.
of neat and fun.
Right. And Joe Quesada, who's editor-in-chief of Marvel, and the big kahuna out there of comic books, he said that, you know, a lot of these comic books are now actually put together and colored and lettered on a computer. And so when they're printed on a comic page, there's a lot of seepage in the ink, and it loses a lot of its vibrancy. But if you were to transmit some of these same pages on an iPad screen, you are seeing the picture the way the artist saw the picture and the way that the artist visualized it. So in some ways, the digital version is perhaps a more faithful version of the comic than the printed version, in kind of this, you know, turnabout way.
Well, the form has its detractors and it has its enthusiasts, much the same way that e-books have their champions and the people that just refuse to pick up an ebook, whether it be on a Kindle or an iPad. I guess it was a week and a half ago, or about a week ago, you wrote a story called Electronic Reading Devices Transforming the Definition of Book, although I think I got that headline a tad wrong. But I found that it was a fascinating article that really talked about how as electronic reading devices proliferate, that books are kind of transforming, aren't they?
Yeah, they're, you know, when you free the words from the printed page, they start morphing into other things. One of the ways, for example, is that they start taking on the characteristics of other types of media. You're starting to see books that integrate video and audio more seamlessly into the reading experience to enhance the reading experience. Another way is that, you know, reading, which is kind of a solitary experience, you sort of sit there and you are there with the book, It's starting to become a more social experience. You know, people are reading things together online, or they are communicating through a book. For example, this is I love this example because it shows how a textbook is kind of turning out to be a living book. I spoke to a physicist who's been writing several versions of a physics textbook that he himself studied from when he was at MIT as a graduate student many years ago. 20 years later, he was asked by the publisher to be the editor of that textbook, and he agreed, and he edited several versions of that textbook through about a dozen years. And then when it became time for it to be an online book, he's embedded little communication tools so that the professor and the writer can communicate with students who are using the book through the book itself. The author of this book, he's in his 70s now. He's really enjoying the ability to interact and communicate with his students and his readers in a new way now. He says, as a teacher, I've always wanted to be there with my student when they're doing the problem set and sit beside them and sort of guide them through it. But most of the time I can't do that because, you know, my students are always doing the assignments, you know, 2 a.m. the night before it's due. So this is sort of my way of being there right next to them without actually having to be there. So it's sort of asynchronous communication between the author and the reader. I was talking with Anne Rice, and she said that she has a Facebook page in which she checks in twice a day. She answers virtually all of her email, and she has a book out. And she says it's a simple matter of embedding some of those communication tools within her digital book so that she too can communicate with her readers and writers.
Well, there's a couple issues that you've raised. One is the really smart use of video and added-on features for things like textbooks or how-to books or cookbooks, where a video demonstration or to visually see something makes a lot of sense. And then there is the standard novel, which I think for 99% of the time, you're not going to spend $10,000 to shoot videos or illustrate a chapter of a book or do elaborate things with it because it's not necessary. And often you have an online presence. That's very important. And a community, that's great if you can build one. But, you know, John Lipdick's new novel doesn't need a video attachment. It's nice, an author interview, but it's not going to change the world.
No, I don't think so. It's not a dramatic change. And, you know, you have to look at the source material. Is it something that could benefit from a video or audio or some other digital interaction? But if it doesn't, then there's no reason for it to be there. But then there are some cases where it does benefit the book. I think you have to look at it as a way of enhancing the book as opposed to a gimmick. There's one that I saw that I thought did a pretty good job, and that is a biography of the Guns N' Roses guys. And the person who wrote it collected a lot of photographs over the years, and I guess he had known these guys for over the decades, and he collected a bunch of things, a bunch of photos and interviews, and so in some ways, you know, at the end of the day, when you look at all of his materials, he had a lot of audio interviews, video interviews, photos, as well as, you know, as the words themselves. And in some ways, you know, a digital book is probably the best way to present that material.
Well, Alex, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us about this subject. You can find Alex's writing on the Los Angeles Times, and I'm sure the Future of Reading series will continue into the future. Do you have a Twitter account we can plug?
Sure, it's just at Alex Pham.
Oh, incredibly easy. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, from Alex Pham, writing about digital comic books and digital books, we're going to be switching gears and talking to Rachel Deal, a senior news editor at Publishers Weekly, about some big news in the ebook world that occurred, I guess, this past week, and it's been the talk of the publishing industry. Rachel, why don't you explain what happened over the past week?
The big thing that happened was Andrew Wiley, who runs the Wiley Agency, which is a literary agency, launched a new company, essentially a sort of publishing company that would release ebook editions of some pretty big backlist titles, including Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth. And not only was this really big news because suddenly we had an agency sort of becoming a publisher, but another sort of piece of the puzzle was that the Wiley Agency signed a deal to sell these books exclusively through Amazon as Kindle editions. I guess I should also add that basically what this deal speaks to is a growing concern and sort of an issue in publishing about digital rights, especially to backlist ebooks. Basically, the contracts for these books were, you know, drawn up before ebooks existed. To some extent, there are some legal questions about whether the Wiley Agency has the rights to do this, you know, i.e., do authors and in some cases estates sort of have the digital rights to those books. So that's one issue, but it speaks to a lot of other issues in the industry now over sort of, again, over ebooks and publishing and retailing. I mean, it really, a host of issues that are of concern to sort of everybody in the business.
Now, Rachel, obviously this particular case will resolve itself legally as to whether they actually have their ebook rights and what they actually entail, whether a competing clause in a contract might not make that appropriate. But beyond this particular case, this does seem to mirror what happened in the music industry and the idea that ultimately there are going to be authors who are going to go it alone even without a publisher for anything, much less their ebook rights. You're going to see people who already have established names, like, say, a Stephen King or a Philip Roth, say, I pay for a publisher. They barely copy edit my books anymore. They don't spend a lot of money on advertising. I might as well just go it alone.
Right. I mean, that's definitely something that's cropping up. You know, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but, you know, I think a lot of people are sort of questioning, especially in the, you know, in this digital age, what's the point of a publisher? What's the point of a print publisher? And a lot of the backlash that's happened as a result of the Wiley thing that brings up a lot of these issues is, I think, people sort of overlooking and sort of not necessarily understanding all the things that a publisher actually does. And, you know, speaking to somebody like Stephen King, you know, that's a good example of somebody who could, you know, if he wanted, he's an author of a, you know, certain stature, that he could definitely publish his own books, you know, and not deal with a publisher. But I think the reason a lot of people like Stephen King haven't done that is because it's a lot of work to do that. I mean, right now, as big as the ebook market is, and, you know, Amazon just said that they had, in the last 3 months, sold more ebooks than hardcovers. Nonetheless, the hardcover market right now still dominates the industry. And if you're Stephen King, it's a lot of work. If you're publishing more than 1 million books, say, of your next novel, it's no easy task to get out there and market that yourself, to get those books into bookstores. And, you know, even if you're dealing with only a digital print run, it's still, like I said, a lot of work. You know, people constantly bring up, you know, the music industry as a parallel to the publishing industry. And, you know, I think there are questions that people need to ask. Like, is the music industry right now, as fractured as it is, better off than it was before? I'm not an expert on the music industry, but I would say no. I mean, I think there are a lot of downsides to what's happened in the music industry. You know, a lot of people are questioning whether or not what happened, what's going on with Andrew Wiley's new venture is, you know, something that's going to be good for publishing. I mean, if things like this keep happening, if agents, you know, become publishers, if more big name authors try to publish their own books, you know, I don't know that that's going to be a good thing for the publishing industry as a whole. And I mean, I think the real question is, in all of this, are publishers going to start sort of raising their digital royalty rates?
Well, the name of Andrew Wiley's new venture is Odyssey Editions. And Karen, you know this from working at agencies, much like myself, that, you know, a talent agency, at least a creative artist agency or a William Morris, cannot produce their own television show or their own films. They represent their clients and that's it. It would be a conflict of interest if they represented both their clients and then produced the work.
Well, they do package them, so.
Yeah, that's true.
That's where they, you know, it's fuzzy.
Well, and I would have thought that there would be something in the contracts that these writers and authors sign that said that, you know, we own the rights to this work into the future for any medium that is present or yet to be invented. And Random House, you wrote a piece about Random House being prepared to challenge Wiley and their new business.
Right. I mean, it is an issue. I mean, I don't, the Authors Guild released a statement today actually speaking to this, and they cite the case about a couple of years ago, Rosetta Books versus Random House, that states, I mean, there was boilerplate in these contracts, I believe, that, you know, did speak to future sort of, you know, in vague language to future versions of books that didn't exist yet. Again, the Authors Guild, and they're citing this previous case, feels that the authors retain these digital rights. I mean, I think one thing that's happening with Odyssey Editions to some extent is, you know, I don't know how many agencies, Andrew Wiley's included, really want to become publishers. I think to a certain extent, they're truly trying to push publishers' hand to raise these digital royalty rates. And I mean, one thing that has been going on is, you know, agents have been asking to bump it up past 25%, which is the standard. Publishers have been refusing, and these titles have been languishing. I mean, there are all these backlist books that aren't available in ebook. So, I mean, one thing Andrew Wiley did by starting Odyssey Editions is he sort of got this ball rolling and said, well, to an extent, to the publisher, if you're not going to do anything with these rights, I'm going to. One thing Andrew Wiley was really trying to do was sort of to say to the publisher, to say to publishers in general, you know, you guys need to act on this stuff. And this is what the Authors Guild was talking about today, that these books are of value. There's money sitting there to be made for these authors. And the publishers need to start addressing that. They need to start looking at these old contracts. They need to start negotiating for a better royalty rate. Otherwise, things they don't want to see happening, i.e. agents becoming publishers, will continue to happen.
Well, certainly it's a story that will not end here, and I'm sure we will be talking about this again sometime in the future. So I appreciate, and I should speak for Karen and Michael here, we appreciate you taking the time to explain it all to us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Well, that was good of her to stop by and talk about that. Her article in Publishers Weekly is definitely worth checking out. It's really interesting. She talked about how, you know, if you hurt the publishing industry and walk away from them, you'll find out that they did a lot of good stuff you didn't appreciate. And I think she's right, and what happened to the music industry hurt them, but nobody wanted what happened to the music industry to actually happen to it. I mean, it happened because events overtook it. People started going to digital. The music companies weren't making their stuff available. And I think that's the same thing that's happening in publishing. They're not staying on top of it, and they're not reacting to the new world that they're in. And they could get crushed, and a lot of authors who aren't famous like Stephen King will find out they miss having a publisher, but it's going to happen anyway.
Well, and since we're talking about music, I guess maybe we should move on to talk about music, at least briefly. We have one story here that we've highlighted, which is kind of an unfortunate story about a stampede at the Love Parade Festival, which is an electronica musica festival in Germany. And it's been going on since 1989. And over the weekend, 19 people were trampled to death in a tunnel when police tried to stop the crowds from entering the concert grounds.
It's obviously really sad. I think I read that they've canceled it forever, that a festival will never happen again. I'm not sure what the issues are as far as proper security, but as these festivals go bigger and bigger, and as Sperling mentioned to me earlier, you know, this is the only growing part of the live concert business. They have to make sure they have the right security measures in place to deal with the crowds to show up.
Right, and we're not going to go into the whole concert business here this week. Maybe we'll do it on a following week. But yeah, that's really it. I mean, 1 million people were attending this event. According to the promoters, they said it was up to 1.4 million. They were stuck in this tunnel. And I mean, Karen, I don't know if you recall when we covered Coachella, it was just packed. They had, I think, 75,000 people there per day. And it was hard to walk around the grounds. And it's because these promoters are trying to get more out of each of their events, because it really is the only way to make money off of them.
Yes, that's true. Though we don't know if they failed on security or whether it just was an unfortunate accident or what the reason was for this, the crushing death. Obviously, if proper procedures are in place, it shouldn't happen.
Well, I can tell you that attending some of these festivals, it seems to me year after year that they just get police officers and security guards in who don't necessarily know how to handle a crowd that large.
It's a special skill. I mean, I'm at Yankee Stadium all the time, and when there are police officers or security guards who are there and know what to do and are regularly there, it's safer. And when they don't know what to do and they're not trained to deal with a crowd in that situation, things develop out of control that never needed to. It could have been stopped, but I would know what to do better than a lot of the cops, you know, police officers in general. Obviously, tough, scary job, wonderful people, but, you know, it's a skill. You need to learn what to do in that game with 75,000 people watching a baseball game. If you've got 100,000 people or a million people at a concert, you need to learn new skills.
Yeah, well, and, you know, again, we'll talk about the concert industry some other time. Now we should probably move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly lightning round segment where we discuss the top entertainment headlines of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first headline for this week, Lindsay Lohan heads to jail. Needless to say, the event was broadcast live on cable news networks with fans there for moral support and one person even showering the jailbird to be with confetti, which I thought was really strange. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Sadly, it is a big whoop. But my sister was working right down the street, and it was like she couldn't even get any work done because the helicopters were so loud flying above her. I thought that was kind of cool.
Michael?
It's a big deal that you would see something like this on the cable news channels live as if it was a big deal. It's sad how much news has fallen. That's all I can think about it.
Our next story is about television. For TV, the only viewers that really matter are people aged 18 to 34. And this summer, which network is number one in that demo? Is it ABC? Is it CBS? Maybe Fox or NBC? Maybe even the CW, although highly unlikely. None of those are the correct answer. It's Univision, the Latino-geared channel, thanks to telenovelas like Hasta Que El Dinero No Se... Oh, you know what? I'm going to butcher this, so I'm just going to say it's For Love or Money in English, and I apologize to our Spanish listeners. And Karen's favorite, So Tu Dueña? Woman of Steel. So, Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Sí, es grande acuerdo.
Okay, and Karen.
Actually, I was Rosarita in my Spanish class. This was a big deal about 5 years ago. This is a big whoop now.
Yeah,
this is not news that Univision is so popular. That's why they tried to do telenovelas on...
They were not number one 5 years ago. They keep growing. Yeah. They're the number one news market in New York. I think it's a big deal as far as the growing Hispanic audience and the appeal of their programming for anyone, even if you don't speak Spanish.
Our next story is about somebody else going to jail. Federal prosecutors asked a judge on Wednesday to revoke bail for actor Wesley Snipes and order him to prison immediately to begin serving a 3-year sentence for failing to file federal income tax returns from 2000 to 2005. He lost an appeals court ruling, so he's got no place else to turn. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a huge deal. I love this story.
Michael?
It's a big whoop. He's guilty. We've known it for a while.
Yeah, but he's going to prison. It's so cool.
Moving on, American Idol is starting to hold auditions around the country for its crucial 10th season, and Fox is going into overdrive on finding a replacement for the acerbic Simon Cowell. Grammy-winning producer Steve Lillywhite has pushed himself in an online campaign, and even Donald Trump has thrown his hat into the ring. Maybe the Donald is also his rapper persona. Usher seemed to be auditioning during his stint on the show, as did the affable and very funny Harry Connick Jr. The latest name to gain traction? Rocker Chris Isaak, who is wickedly funny, brings rock and roll credibility, and is damn easy on the eye. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
None of those are true. They've pretty much already decided who they're going to have. It's none of those people.
And who is it?
I'm not going to tell you. I can't tell you.
Oh, come on. Come on.
Let me just say, who are you?
Roger Daltrey, Pete Townsend.
That's impossible. That would be horrible choices.
Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
If it's somebody from The Who, it would be a terrible choice. I think it's a big deal for Chris Isaak because I think he'd be a great choice. He's a really, really good choice. But apparently Karen already knows him.
No, he's a terrible choice. He's way too nice. You don't want somebody nice. You're going to have nothing but a panel of nice people.
I don't know how nice he can be. He can be pretty acerbic.
Well, maybe they can get Justin Bieber to do it, although he might be too nice too. And maybe CSI stands for Child Services Incorporated. In any case, teen idol Justin Bieber will guest star on the season premiere of CSI starting September 23rd when he plays a quote-unquote troubled teen. So he'll really have to stretch himself to act that one out. Apparently, when Bieber sang the song My World, he wasn't kidding. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for CSI because they're going to lower their audience age from about 60 down to maybe 50 or 40.
Karen?
Yeah, no, I would agree with you, Michael, except what's interesting is that I posted this bit of news on one of the social media channels that I manage, and it's a channel of an age range from teens to 60-year-olds. And across the board, everyone was just like, boo, hiss, Bieber sucks. And I thought that was fascinating.
Well, I've got a question for you, Karen. Who do you think they're going to hire to replace Simon Cowell?
Didn't we already talk about this?
No, yeah, but I figured I would try and trick you into telling us.
Honestly, I know that they are in serious negotiations with somebody that we may or may not have just named. I can't say for sure that he's doing it, but I know that they're in serious negotiations.
Well, then we should move on to our next story. One of the big hits of Sundance was Catfish, a documentary film about an online relationship that took unexpected twists and turns. The movie's plot was so crucial to its enjoyment that people repeatedly said, the less you know, the better. And that, by the way, one of those people was me. And now they're turning it into a reality TV series? Huh? Actually, the plan is to develop a show built on relationships that started online, not the specific one in the film. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal if it works.
Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. And why do they need to buy the rights to this show to do it? I don't get it.
Yeah, I think it's a big whoop, too. I mean, they're just now shopping it around, and so, you know, it hasn't even sold yet. The villain in the next Batman film? Unless we're dreaming, and who can say, we believe it's going to be the Riddler. That's what the website First Showing has said. First Showing, Alex Billington's home. According to a reliable inside source talking about director Christopher Nolan's next project, as for who is playing the Riddler, that's still to be decided, though Joseph Gordon-Levitt is one possibility. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's kind of a big whoop. It's just somebody else possibly getting a job. Although, is it just me or is Joseph Gordon-Levitt turning into Heath Ledger?
Don't ever criticize Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
No, I'm not. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love but, him. I mean that in a good way.
It's a big whoop. So they may know what villain they're focusing on. Who cares?
Yeah, and this is what this story was based on. And I should have ribbed Alex a little bit about it when he was on. This was based on a casting grid that was found at Warner Brothers. And Karen, you and I both know those grids are like wish lists.
Yeah, that means nothing.
That means nothing. Maybe it means the Riddler.
No, but it's not about JGL. It's just about simply whether the Riddler is the villain they're focusing on. That's the tidbit.
Yeah. Oh,
okay, well, yeah, if that's the
case.
But
even that might not mean anything.
Yeah. Did you watch the season premiere of Mad Men on AMC?
No.
Can I borrow $50? According to Nielsen, 48% of its viewers live in a household that earns $100,000 or more. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop since the show is extremely low rated, frankly, even for AMC. So they need all the rich viewers they can get.
Karen?
Second there, I thought you were going to tell me what I missed last night. No, I agree with Michael.
I'll tell you one of the things you missed. It was sponsored by BMW, which makes sense since 48% of its viewers live in a household that earns more than $100,000 per year. All musicals are equal, but some musicals are more equal than others. And that applies especially to Billy Elliot, the smash hit show based on a movie. Elton John and Lee Hall are eyeing their follow-up to the worldwide success story, George Orwell's Animal Farm. The project is at least 2 years away from a workshop production, so don't get online yet. But Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. 2 years away from a workshop production? Pretty far away.
Michael, Animal Farm, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's the next project from a hugely successful team.
Moving on, Disney has been pimping the new Tron, the Legacy film, for 3.5 years. A New York Times article talks about the general trend of getting the word out about tentpole movies early and often, with 1 year of promotion seeming to be the minimum for a major flick, including teaser trailers, appearances at conventions, websites, print ads, theme park tie-ins, and more. Of course, the danger is getting people sick of your movie long before it ever comes out. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I've noticed it so much. I remember the first time I saw a trailer for a movie like coming next summer. You're like, oh my God, it's 8 months away. Now we see one for 1 year, 2 year in advance. It happens all the time.
Karen?
He says it's a big deal for that reason. I think it's a big whoop for that reason.
Okay, moving on then. Netflix wants to be your video streaming provider. The company that began by shipping DVDs to people has been pushing hard into the streaming world. Of course, we've talked about this on past episodes. They're offering an ever-increasing list of TV shows and movies online immediately to its subscribers. Now it's going international, and the first stop is Canada. The service starts in the fall. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, the real question is, are we talking about the fact that the first stop is Canada, or are we talking about that they're focusing on streaming? If we're talking the focusing is on streaming, that's a big deal, because that's going to be the future for Netflix.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal. It's a big deal that their streaming is the future for them. It's a big deal that they're moving into Canada. The next obvious step is, you know, Latin America, Europe, and buy your Netflix stuff now.
Okay, well, I think we made out that it was a big deal there. But here's why it's a really big deal. It's the first streaming-only subscription that Netflix is offering, and it's proving that they can go international, that they can get these rights not just for the United States, but for all of North America and potentially other international territories.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a little insidery and kind of a little nerdy to say all of that, but I think that's why it's a big deal. And that, by the way, Michael, was our segue into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss only the news stories that Hollywood might care about. And this week, Michael, you have a story for us.
Michael posted this story for us to talk about for Inside Baseball. That's not really a story as it is so much as a giggle behind your hand thing. It's about how Sumner Redstone essentially sort of lost it. And he is the head of Viacom. He's, you know, one of those really older people who've been around for a while. And, you know, people know who he is. And for whatever reason, he's getting behind this group of bisexual, really sexy women and is forcing, or maybe not forcing, MTV to do a show about them.
Now, he owns MTV, it should be said.
He owns MTV because he owns Viacom and Viacom owns MTV. And the Daily Beast wrote a story saying that Sumner Redstone was forcing MTV to do the series, even though everybody at MTV hated the idea. Then he called this reporter at the Daily Beast to ask who her sources were and left a 3-minute-long voicemail and essentially bribed her to say who her source was. And that's really the story right there. It's just that Sumner Redstone lost it.
But this quote to her, "We're not going to kill him. We just want to talk to him and ask him why he did this. We're not going to kill him." It's one of the things he told the reporter in his message. He said, "We'll protect you and you'll be very well provided for." I mean, it's just bizarre.
And then the story goes on to talk about how Sumner Redstone kind of fancies himself to be a ladies' man. Am I getting this right?
That's right. That's right. He's a Paul Newman, and women are wildly attracted to him, as they are to all billionaires.
No, not wildly. Fatally.
Fatally attracted to him. Yeah, that's
fatally what attracted to all men who are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, even me.
And that's it. Really makes me giggle because, I mean, if anybody has not seen a picture of Sumner Redstone, do Google him. You'll look at him and you will laugh. I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but it is.
And then a friend tries to defend him, producer Arnold Copelson, who's a big Hollywood producer, and he's defending Sumner.
Oh, makes it worse.
He's in extremely good physical condition. He says he has a great complexion, which is smooth and has a healthy pink glow. He eats only foods with antioxidants. He swims every day, I think for about 45 minutes. This man keeps himself in really good shape.
No, it gets worse. And he's divorced. He's dating other women. What? What's that got to do with anything?
Possibly somebody from the band.
Yes, one of the women, by the way, got stock options to Viacom worth $150,000 and cast them in, which was also a controversy.
Oh, well, this is a story that, you know.
Yeah, so it's only funny to people. That's why we have it for Inside Baseball. It's really only just really giggle-worthy for people who know who this man is or who have worked for people who are similarly deluded. So
we've all worked for people who are similarly deluded in this industry. That is for sure. That brings us to the conclusion of this week's show. I'd like to thank our guests. I'm going to start with Rachel Deal, who is the senior news editor over at Publishers Weekly. We also had Alex Billington on, the editor of First Showing, Jeff Boucher, who writes the Hero Complex blog, as well as numerous other pieces for the Los Angeles Times. Anne Thompson can be found on her blog, Thompson on Hollywood, over at IndieWire. And Alex Pham, who talked to us about digital comics and ebooks, she's at the LA Times. We'll place links to all of their stories and all of their Twitter accounts in the show notes. Now, we didn't have time to read any listener email this week, but if you want to write us, the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter and Facebook. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward can be found on her website, karenwoodwardonline.com. She's also on Twitter. @Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Michael Giltz can be found, I guess, on any street corner, apparently. That's where you can find Michael Giltz.
And he means that in the Clute kind of way.
Yes. Well, he can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. That's where links to all of his writing appears. And he's also on Twitter. Michael Giltz is the username to look up. I'm on Twitter. Sperling is the username to look up. Or you can find some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.